You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, How to Turn Your Independent Film into a Money-Making Business by Alex Ferrari. For a free copy of the audiobook, head over to www.filmbizbook.com.
Welcome to the Director Series Podcast, a show dedicated to deconstructing the work of some of cinema's most celebrated and influential film directors. I'm your host, Cameron Bile.
As the Swedish film trilogy proved successful both at home and abroad, it was inevitable that the major U.S. studios would remake the property for American audiences. The task fell to Sony Pictures, who set up The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo with super producer Scott Rudin, overseeing a screenplay by esteemed writer Steve Zaillian. Rudin's natural choice for a director was Fincher, who he had just worked with on The Social Network. Fincher was drawn to the story of two mismatched misfits trying to solve a decades-old murder, despite misgivings that he had become the go-to guy for serial killer films after the success of Seven and Zodiac. The tipping point came in Fincher's realization that he would be at the helm of one of the rarest projects in mainstream studio filmmaking, the hard R-rated franchise.
What I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you a story, and if it entertains you, maybe you'll decide to help me research further, and if not, I'll do the washing up and you'll never see me again.
What kind of research?
I want you to help me catch a killer of women.
James Bond himself headlines Fincher's Pitch Black tale, but it's a testament to Daniel Craig's ability that we're never actually reminded of his secret agent exploits throughout the nearly three-hour running time.
One thing the Vangers have more than their fair share of is anti-Semites.
There's one. Right there.
Craig has been able to avoid the sort of typecasting that doomed others like Pierce Brosnan before him, simply because he refuses to let his roles define him. As disgraced journalist Mikhail Bloomquist, he projects a slightly disheveled appearance that James Bond would never be caught dead in. It may not be the most memorable role of his career, but he turns in a solid, faultless performance regardless.
They say I'm insane. No, it's okay, you can nod, because it's true. I am insane.
The true spotlight goes to Rooney Mara's cold, antisocial hacker punk, Lisbeth Salander. Mara underwent a radical transformation for the role, even so far as getting real piercings, tattoos, dye jobs, and bleaching her eyebrows. Considering her previous collaboration with Fincher was as the squeaky clean girl next door in The Social Network, Mara's appearance in The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo is gut-level arresting.
May I go?
Moment. Your report is light in another area. His personal life. Anything you chose not to disclose?
He's had a long-standing sexual relationship with his co-editor of the magazine. It wrecked his marriage, but not hers. Sometimes he performs cunnilingus. Not often enough, in my opinion.
The depth of Mara's talent is evident in her unflinching confrontation with the most brutal aspects of her character arc. By giving herself over to the role entirely, she's able to take a character that was already so well-defined by Rapace in the Swedish versions and make it completely her own. Her Best Actress nomination at the Oscars was very much deserved. Christopher Plummer, Stellan Skarsgård, and Robin Wright round out Fincher's compelling cast. Plummer is convincing as Henrik Wenge, depicting the retired industrialist as a good-natured yet haunted old man.
You will be investigating thieves, misers, bullies, the most detestable collection of people that you will ever meet. My family.
Skarsgård's Martin Wenge is the current CEO of the family business, and his established gentleman persona cleverly hides his psychopathic, murderous inclinations.
Paul, Mikael, you know what this is going to look like.
Yeah. Like I've been gutted, like I'm running away. I am. Beniston wants to see me waving a white flag, not a red flag. The more it looks like there's a problem between you and me, the more it'll satisfy.
There is a problem between you and me. He won't be satisfied until he shuts us down. You're leaving me here to fight him alone.
Wright plays Erica Berger, Blomquist's co-editor at Millennium and his on-again, off-again lover. Wright is by her nature an intelligent and savvy woman, as evidenced not just here, but in her subsequent collaboration with Fincher in House of Cards.
So we're just going to come straight down the middle of this on the 21. I think we're going to want to be up kind of this height, and I'll stabilize it later. So.
In keeping with Fincher's affinity for digital filmmaking technology, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo takes advantage of the Red Epic digital cameras, the next generation of the type that The Social Network was shot on. The film is presented in Fincher's preferred 240:1 aspect ratio, but again, it's not true anamorphic. Besides being a reflection of Fincher's general distaste for the limitations of anamorphic lenses, the shooting of the image in full frame and the later addition of a widescreen mat in post-production is a testament to Fincher's need for control. This method allows him to compose the frame exactly as he wants, and the Red Epic's ability to capture 5,000 lines of resolution allows him an even greater degree of precision in zooming in on certain details, blowing up the image, or recomposing the shot without any loss in picture quality. This technology also affords better image stabilization without any of the warping artifacts that plagued the process. Cinematographer Jeff Cronenworth returns for his third collaboration with Fincher, having replaced original director of photography Frederick Bakar 8 weeks into the shoot for reasons unknown. Despite his initial position as a replacement DP, Cronenworth makes the picture his own, with his efforts rewarded by another Oscar nomination. Fincher's signature aesthetic is very appropriate for the wintry subject matter. His steely color palette of blues, greens, and teals evoke the stark Swedish landscape, and even warmer tones are dialed back to a colder yellow in Fincher's hands. The high contrast visuals are augmented by realistically placed practical lights that suggest cavernous interiors. Fincher's sedate camera eschews flash in favor of locked-off, strong compositions and observant, calculated dolly work. When the camera moves, it really stands out in an affecting way. Nowhere in the film is this more evident than the shot where Craig Blomquist is in the car approaching Vanga's extravagant mansion for the first time. Presented from the forward-traveling POV of the car itself, the mansion grows larger in the center of the frame, the symmetrical framing conceit suggesting ominous perfection. The fact that the camera is stabilized makes for a smooth, foreboding shot that takes any sort of human element out of the equation and replaces it with a fundamentally uneasy feeling. Like several key shots in Fincher's larger filmography, the Vanga Estate approach would become a tastemaker shot that has been copied in his successive project House of Cards. Production designer Donald Graham Burt returns for his fourth Fincher film, artfully creating an authentic sense of place in the Swedish locations, while showing off his impeccable taste and eye for detail. Editing team Angus Wall and Kirk Baxter are key collaborators within Fincher's filmography, and The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo would become their second consecutive Oscar win for editing under the director's supervision. Their work for The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo really utilizes the advantages that digital filmmaking has to offer, creating a tone that's moody, but yet unlike conventional missing person thrillers. Angus and Wall establish a patient, plodding pace that draws the audience deeper into the mystery before they're even aware of it, echoing Blomquist's own growing obsession with the case. Trent Reznor and his music partner Atticus Ross reprise their scoring duties, giving the musical palette of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo an appropriately electronic and cold, wintry feeling. Primarily achieved via a recurring motif of bells and ambient soundscapes, the score is also supplemented by a throbbing, heartbeat-like percussion that echoes Salander's simmering anger, as well as the encroaching danger at hand.
Something wrong with the report?
Oh, it was quite thorough, but I'm also interested in what's not in it.
One of Reznor's masterstrokes is his reworking of Led Zeppelin's Immigrant Song for the opening credits and trailer, featuring vocals by Yeah Yeah Yeah's frontwoman Karen O. Given a new coat of industrial electronic grunge, the rearrangement instantly conveys the tone and style of the film. Fincher's needle drops are few and far between in The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, but one Source music track stands out because of the sheer audaciousness of its inclusion. In the scene where Skarsgård's Martin Vanga tortures Blomquist in anticipation of butchering his prey, he fires up the basement stereo system and plays, of all songs, Enya's Orinoco Flow.
It might amuse you to know that while you were upstairs, having moose with me and Lee, who, by the way, finds me very conventional, I had Irina down here in that cage.
The song acts as a hilarious counterpoint to the sheer darkness of the scene's events. However, our laughter becomes a nervous sort of chuckle, the kind we employ to hide a certain kind of fundamental unease and anxiety. Fincher's go-to sound guy, Ren Kleiss, was nominated for yet another Oscar with his standout mix, taking this noxious brew of sounds and turning it into a razor-sharp sonic landscape that complements Fincher's visuals perfectly. On his face, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo doesn't seem like it would call for a substantial amount of computer-generated visual effects. Fincher's background in VFX results in the incorporation of a surprisingly large quantity of effect shots. Almost every exterior shot during the Vanga sequences has some degree of digital manipulation applied to it in the way of subtle matte paintings, scenery extensions, and weather elements that blend together seamlessly to convey Fincher's moody vision and satisfy his desire for total control over his visuals. His affinity for imaginative opening title sequences also continues here. Set to the aforementioned Immigrant Song cover, the sequence plays like a dark nightmare version of those iconic James Bond title sequences, depicting key moments from the film in abstract, archetypical form, as a thick black ooze splashes around violently. The choice to incorporate a black-on-black color scheme is undeniably stylish.
You're backed up, are you?
I'll drive you to home, yeah.
Okay, that's good, because this one's done.
The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo sees Fincher at the peak of his punk and technological aesthetic explorations. While she's not Fincher's creation, the character of Lisbeth Salander fits in quite comfortably within his larger body of work, the culmination of a long flirtation with punk culture. She is most certainly a product of the cyberpunk mentality, valuing rebelliousness through technological proficiency. Unlike other depictions of the subculture in mass media, it's easy to see that Fincher obviously respects it for what it is, and aims to portray it in a realistic manner. Here, he builds upon the downplayed foundation he laid in The Social Network by refusing to generate fake interfaces for Salander to use. He shows Salander actively Googling things or looking people up on Wikipedia. He doesn't shy away from showing corporate logos and interfaces as they appear in real life. Fincher's body of work is defined by a distinctly nihilistic approach to story and character. With The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo in particular, these sentiments are a prominent part of the storytelling. These protagonists are morally flawed people who aren't afraid of doing bad things to get ahead.
I'll call Gregor and tell him I'm not coming home.
They're mostly atheists, and they don't care whether you like them or not. The themes of abuse that run through the narrative also reflect this overarching mentality, playing out in the form of authority figures exerting their influence and selfish desires over the women that depend on them. We see this reflected both on the bureaucratic level with Salander's lecherous caseworker, as well as on the familial level in Harriet Vanga's repeated rape and abuse at the hands of her brother. Architecture plays a subtle yet evocative role in The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. One of the core themes of the story is the clash between New Sweden, represented by Salander's weapons-grade sexual ambiguity and technical proficiency, and Old Sweden, represented by the Vanga family's moneyed lifestyle and sprawling compound. This clash is echoed in the architecture that Fincher chooses to present. The Vanga estate consists of classical stylings and rustic cottages. Compare that to the harsh lines and modern trappings of Martin Vanga's minimalist cliffside residence, all clean lines and floored ceiling glass, as well as the whole of Stockholm, very much the model of a modern European city. In showing us this duality of place and time, Fincher is able to draw a line that also points us directly to the narrative's major emphasis on the duality of man. Despite its effortless style and Oscar-caliber performances, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo never really connected with audiences. It opened at a disadvantage, placing third in its debut weekend and never rising above it during the rest of its run. There were, of course, the inevitable comparisons to the original series of film adaptations, with purists preferring them over Fincher's remake. Unfortunately, we will probably never get to see what Fincher would have done with the remaining two entries in the series, as the poor box office performance of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo most likely put the kibosh on further installments.
Thank you for listening to the Director Series. For a deeper dive into your favorite filmmakers, go to www.directorseries.net. The Director Series is made possible in large part by your generous supporters on Patreon. Please visit us at patreon.com/directorseries to see how your contribution enables the continued production of video essays and text articles on your favorite contemporary and classic film directors. Thank you.